From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We've done an incredible job with Syria. When I took over Syria, it was infested with ISIS. It was all over the place. And now you have very little ISIS, and you have the caliphate almost knocked out.
That was President Donald Trump in a Face the Nation interview, which aired Super Bowl Sunday and was recorded the prior Friday, February 1st. The president had been asked about a disagreement between himself and some of his top intelligence advisors, particularly over his plans to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria and, ultimately, Afghanistan.
I think we've done a great job with that. At the same time, at a certain point, we want to bring our people back home. If you look at Afghanistan, we're going in very soon. We'll be going into our 19th year, spending $50 billion a year. Now, if you go back and look at any of my campaign speeches or rallies, I talked about it all the time.
You did.
Look, we're protecting the world. We're spending more money than anybody's ever spent in history by a lot. We spent, over the last 5 years, close to $50 billion a year in Afghanistan. That's more than most countries spend for everything, including education, medical, and everything else.
Is there a scenario where you would keep troops in Afghanistan, a smaller number? I mean,
yes, and I'll leave intelligence there, real intelligence, by the way. I'll leave intelligence there, and if I see nests forming, I'll do something about it. But for us to be spending $51 billion, like last year, or if you average the cost, you're talking about numbers that nobody's ever heard of before.
The Senate Republicans voted, vast majority of them said that they don't support what you're doing, that what you're doing risks national intelligence by a precipitous withdrawal from Syria and Afghanistan. Doesn't that concern you?
I ran against 17 Republicans. This was a big part of what I was saying, and I won very easily. I think the people out in the world, I think people in our country agree. We've been fighting for 19 years. Somebody said you're precipitously bringing to... Precipitously, we've been there for 19 years.
During the conversation, President Trump said that he did not need to keep troops in Syria in order to keep an eye on events in the Middle East, in particular on Iran. He made this reference to the massive U.S. military base that's been built in Iraq during the past three presidential administrations.
We spent a fortune on building this incredible base. We might as well keep it. And one of the reasons I want to keep it is because I want to be looking a little bit at Iran, because Iran is a real problem.
Whoa, that's news. You're keeping troops in Iraq because you want to be able to strike in Iran?
No, because I want to be able to watch Iran. All I want to do is be able to watch. We have an unbelievable and expensive military base built in Iraq. It's perfectly situated for looking at all over different parts of the troubled Middle East. Mm-hmm. Rather than pulling up, and this is what a lot of people don't understand, we're going to keep watching and we're going to keep seeing. And if there's trouble, if somebody's looking to do nuclear weapons or other things, we're going to know it before they do.
So you're going to trust the intelligence that you receive?
I am going to trust the intelligence that I'm putting there.
The president's comments drew some very angry responses from across the political spectrum in Iraq, but not from everyone there. This is former Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. He spoke with RT's Sophie Shevardnadze about President Trump's comments and about the present relationship between Iraq and the U.S.
Well, this is very, very unfortunate, because there is an understanding and agreement that the existence of foreign troops, including U.S. forces here in Iraq, is to help Iraqi government fight terrorism. It's not a job of foreign troops to spy on our neighbors or use Iraq as springboard against our neighbors. This is not allowed in our constitution, Iraqi constitution, and this is not part of the whole of this operation. The number of U.S. troops in Iraq are limited. They don't have free movement in Iraq. They have to move with the consent of the Iraqi government. They don't have barracks for their own. They don't control the sky. Any flight in Iraq or outside Iraq should be by the agreement of the Iraqi government. So I think the whole thing is outside the scope of the relationship between the two countries. This is very unfortunate.
Can Iraqi forces maintain security on their own if Baghdad shows America the door?
Well, Iraqis gave a lot of sacrifices to fight Daesh. The people who fought on the ground are only Iraqis. Yes, we receive support. We receive support from our allies, from international coalition, and from the rest of our friends in terms of logistic, in terms of training, and in terms of providing some air cover to support our forces. But in actual fact, the only forces who are fighting on the ground are Iraqis. Yes, we can sustain this by on our own, but I think this is not right. Terrorism is an international phenomenon, and Daesh is an international terrorist organization who not only have threatened Iraq, but threatened the region and the whole world. So it is right for the countries to cooperate to face this enemy and to quash them. And I think we have to work together. So yes, we have to work with the others in order to get rid of this terrorist organization altogether.
So the head of a Shia militia group said that the Iraq has capabilities to expel U.S. troops if needed. Are the Iraqi militias fired up enough to actually come to blows with the U.S. forces in the country?
Well, according to the Iraqi constitution, there is no place for militias in the country. By militias, I mean armed groups who are outside the control of the state. This is against the state, against the Iraqi people, and should not be allowed. We didn't allow it, and we will not allow it. If there are rogue elements who are acting outside the state, they will be the enemies of Iraq. They should not be allowed inside Iraq. As opposed to the other armed groups who are within the state. We have the army, we have the police, we have the public mobilization force who have been now organized by the law, which is legislated by parliament, which is applicable now to the public mobilization force, who are within the framework of the Iraqi security apparatus, and they are answerable to the commander-in-chief and to the rest of the security apparatus. If you ask me, do we allow rogue elements or elements who are outside the control of the state to act in Iraq? No, we shouldn't. This is outside the Iraqi, against the Iraqi constitution, against the will of the people, and is not allowed in Iraq.
So the calls for the U.S. withdrawal were also sparked by the fact that during his surprise visit in late December, President Trump didn't bother to meet any Iraqi officials. Is this insult something that could have long-term repercussions for U.S.-Iraqi ties?
Well, again, I think it is, according to Mr. Trump, this is his will. He wanted to visit his troops during Christmas time. This is his own decision. On the other side, the Iraqi government gave permission to Mr. Trump to visit his troops in the Ain al-Assad barrack in western Al-Anbar. In my opinion, this was not organized properly. I think from day one, it should have been organized in a way for officials, Iraqi government officials, to meet the president of the U.S. when he comes to Iraq. And the meeting could have been done in Baghdad. But I think it may be mismanagement which has led to this. This was unnecessary at all. It has poisoned the relationship slightly. But I hope we should move forward and forget about it.
So at the same time, during the crucial stages of the war against ISIS, United States air power came to Iraq's aid, and the coalition helped Iraq retake Mosul. Do you think that it's a bit ungrateful from the Iraqi politicians to be blaming the Americans now and bragging about Iraqi independence? I mean, when everyone was so happy to receive help in its time of crisis, nobody wanted them out back then.
Well, I think, this is the habit of politicians in every country. I mean, they look at the day-to-day running of the country, and of course they want to attract support from their constituents. I think at the time it's true that our allies, they stood with us to fight our enemy, the terrorists. But it doesn't mean that you give a blank check to whoever has helped us. Yes, we have to be grateful for those who stood with us. But at the same time, Iraqi sovereignty is very important. And the war is over. If there is no need for the troops to stay in Iraq, then there is no need. But if there is a need, we should think it over. We should discuss it in our parliament, with the government, with our political blocs, and we should decide what is the best for Iraq. At the end of the day, What we are going to apply is what is the best for Iraq, and we don't have any hostility to those who helped us to get rid of Daesh at all.
Turkey has bases in northern Iraq set up during the fight against ISIS, from which it fights the Kurds. Now, we hear Iraqi politicians protesting America's presence loud and clear, but they're not so vocal about the Turkish bases. Where's that cry from the Shia militias about that? I mean, is the Iraqi rhetoric condemning Americans just an attempt to look tough and anti-US for voters, maybe?
Well, I think it has become like a war of proxies. You know, there is hostility between the U.S. and Iran, and it's a matter of proxies here in Iraq, where every side is using their proxies in their fight against each other. Yes, I agree. There are few Turkish military bases. They date some of them. They date back to the time or the days of Saddam Hussein when he was in power in the 80s. During the Iran-Iraq war and later on. And of course, we should not accept any military existence of foreign forces without the consent of the Iraqi government. I think, in my opinion, I agree with you, we must be partial on this. It shouldn't be double standard. But after all, we are part of this region, and the disagreement between states, especially between Iran and the United States, it has its impact on us. My call on my colleagues in the political establishment here in Iraq is we should confine our interests in the for the Iraqi people and sovereignty of Iraq. We should not be part of any proxy towards this or that.
So back in 2017, you announced victory over ISIS in Iraq. But ISIS attacks still happen every day in the country, and the group still holds a chunk of desert in the northwest. Was your optimism, shall we say, a little premature? How long is it before ISIS is rooted out completely, if that's ever possible?
Yes, if you go back to 2017, I was very careful. I said we crushed Daesh militarily. We liberated all our land. Daesh doesn't hold any territory inside Iraq, and they don't. What they're holding some territory in eastern or northeastern Syria, which is bordering Iraq, which is very dangerous, because if they are given a chance, they can go back to terrorism. At the moment, the extreme of Daesh, the danger of Daesh, is that they're trying to wage some terrorist attacks against the civilians inside Iraq City. They haven't succeeded yet. We crushed them. We strengthened our intelligence at the time. There is a fear that Daesh is concentrating on another campaign of terrorist attacks against civilians. And I hope our military and our security and intelligence are up to it. They were up to it. And they should carry on with dismantling this very dangerous terrorist organization. This is not only against Iraq, it's against the whole region, against the world, if they are given a chance. So we should stay focused until we eliminate this terrorist organization altogether.
So the United States has a relationship with Iraq, and neighboring Iran has a relationship with Iraq, but United States and Iran are rivals. Can Iraq maneuver between these two centers of power and keep its own independent agenda intact, or will it have to choose sooner or later?
Well, I think our choice is clear. We happen to have the longest border with our neighbor Iran. The U.S. doesn't happen to have a border with the Iran. I'm sure if they had, they would have thought differently how to deal with Iran, how to treat Iran. When you are a neighbor to another state, you have to look at your interests and the common interest between the two nations. We cannot move away from our neighbor. They cannot move away from us. So there's a huge interest. There's history. There's trade. There are a lot of amalgamating interests between our two nations and our two states. We have to safeguard our own interests. We shouldn't be party to this disagreement and this polarization of relationship. It's got nothing to do with us, to be honest with you. This is a nuclear agreement between the 5+1 members of the world community and Iran, and the U.S. decided to walk out of it. And why should we be a party to this? And we should be concentrating on our interests. Our relationship with Iran is very important for us. Our relationship with the U.S. is very important for us. We can achieve a common interest between the two. And we should be very much focused on this, not to allow any party to drag us along the wrong direction.
That was the former Prime Minister of Iraq, Haider al-Abadi, speaking with RT's Sophie Shevardnadze on a recent edition of her program, Sophie & Co.
Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
That was President Trump during his State of the Union address last week. For more on that, we go to this segment from this week's Black Agenda Report, where Professor Anthony Montero speaks with senior editor Glenn Ford.
The speech itself was a demonstration of cheap political campaign rhetoric. And therefore, I don't see anything in it that one who is interested seriously in the direction of human history would take very seriously. On the one side, I saw his attack upon socialism, an attempt to define the Democratic Party, which is a joke, his claim, as a left-wing socialist party. Anybody that knows anything could not take that seriously. Even the so-called socialists in the Democratic Party, I don't consider socialist. Now, on the other side, if he is saying, which maybe he is, that there'll never be another New Deal kind of restructuring or reforming of capitalism, maybe that can be taken seriously and that can be debated. But even on that score, he stands on very, very thin ice, because another great recession, which would be greater than the last 2008 Great Recession, would, in all likelihood, as most commentators are suggesting, morph into something that looks like a Great Depression. And to save not just capitalism, but to save the rule of the ruling class itself would require reforms of a New Deal type. So it's not to be taken seriously. I am not yet prepared to even take what are called socialists seriously as socialists. Now, we can talk a little bit more about that. But I just think the whole discussion of Trump attacking socialists and socialists saying, look, we must be very powerful since Trump attacked us, I think is just a performance on all sides.
Well, certainly a national single-payer health care system is not socialist, or it does not mean that we have a socialist system. After all, most of the rest of the industrial world already has such a system.
Right. And most of the non-industrial world or the developing economies, such as China and Vietnam and North Korea and probably South Korea, have that. I should also mention Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. So the United States, in terms of caring for its people and it being the responsibility ultimately of the state to care for vital needs of the people, we are an outvalue. Most people and nations in the world have accepted a form of capitalism, which also recognizes that to have political and social stability, you have to provide something for the people and you have to regulate the inherent tendencies of capitalism to produce wide inequalities. Our economic model is perhaps unique in the world in regards to not being concerned about that, and a capitalism, as Martin Luther King said, socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the working class and poor. So we're out of touch with the trajectory of history and with humanity, which I should say, by the way, Glenn, because we do not provide those things at the level of the government, because we have this ruthless form of capitalism, it makes our nation more ripe for rebellion and even revolutionary change than would be the case in nations that provide those things, such as Sweden, such even as England or France.
Well, in terms of being out of touch, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party seem to be out of touch with the base voters. 70% and more of Americans as a whole support this slew of proposals made by Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez. We're talking about single payer, but also free college tuition, Ocasio-Cortez's proposal to raise tax rates on the rich to 70%, and of course that Green New Deal proposal, the outlines of which have been revealed already, and which call for a total overhaul of the U.S. economy, not just its industrial parts.
Yeah, the fact that they do it from within the Democratic Party, to me, indicates that these are talking points and they will be talked to death, and that they're not serious in terms of creating the political conditions among the great mass of people. As you say, 70 and 80% of Democrats in particular support a kind of Green New Deal and universal health care without the insurance companies. But the fact that these proposals are made from within the Democratic Party and not from the standpoint of a mass movement suggests to me that they are not serious in terms of being implemented and are, in the end, talking points for the 2020 election and soon after that to be dropped and forgotten. So I hope you would forgive me for my skepticism. I am not cynical, I'm skeptical of a group of socialists who would prefer, rather than building a socialist movement with a program to overhaul the system, are making proposals that look to be leaning in the direction of socialism from within a party that is dominated and controlled by, and in fact exists for the sake of keeping the 1% or the 1/10 of 1% or the corporate imperialists in power.
You seem to be predicting that the Democratic Party will accept these proposals that have super majorities and only dump them after the election, but accept them at convention. Many of us think that this Democratic Party will not allow these proposals to get to the convention, and that this rejection by the party of these supermajority backed proposals could lead to an explosion of the party and a huge defection of disgruntled leftish Democrats.
Well, this is what we're faced with. And, you know, to put it in really stark terms, the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, face crises that are existential. These parties, for the majority of people, are no longer seen as legitimate and useful in the conduct of the people's business, in the pursuant of people's democratic aspirations, be they for health care, be they for green economy or whatever. So, I think the Democratic Party is fighting a struggle to regain some legitimacy or to regain legitimacy as they go into the 2020 election. I don't think that these proposals are serious unless they are based upon building a movement in the industrial states, in these big cities, among the poor. I can think, as I always am thinking, about Philadelphia. Where are the mechanisms to build support for a green economy, for universal health care, and on and on and on? So that's my point. I don't think it's serious. I think the Democrats are trying to build a coalition for 2020. I think they face a real problem at their convention, because as long as they flirt with left, and I put quotes around that, of their party, and have to concede some things, at least in terms of talking points, it does suggest that there will be people who will take it seriously. And when they get to that convention and find out that, well, we could talk about these issues, but that's as far as it's going, then you might have an explosion on the floor of the Democratic Party convention. Something like you had in 2016 when they had to make the Sanders delegates invisible.
Of course, you're correct about movement politics, and we know
right.
where movement politics go during election years. And now we seem to be having a two-year election year. That is, the 2020 election yes. year has already begun.
No question. And, you know, there's a historical precedent of sorts in the 1968 Democratic Party convention. Right now, I have to say, I don't take this left wing of the Democratic Party, including the DSA, serious. I think they want to talk issues to death, but they do not want to build the types of movements to make these talking points into policy. The other thing is, I don't consider it left unless, along with domestic proposals for reform, there is talk of cutting these huge military budgets and ending the U.S. war policies throughout the world.
And in fact, the Democratic Party went along with the Trump budget, which was even bigger than what Trump had asked for the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely, including Bernie Sanders, the most well-known socialist in the United States. So we're at the beginning of something, the end of something, and the beginning of something. I think we have to assess what is going on more clearly. I think included in any discussion of 2020 has to be the crisis of the U.S. dollar, which in many ways explains this Bolton Pompeo Trump coup d'etat or attempted coup d'etat in Venezuela. I think the response of China and Russia and Turkey and Iran to it has to do in large measure with this new aggressiveness with respect to, first of all, a multipolar world and a world that is no longer dominated by the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. In that sense, if the U.S. dollar retreats or is forced to retreat, that means the cost of the U.S. military empire increases, which means in order to pay for the military empire, greater austerity at home. So you cannot detach the call for universal health care, getting rid of the insurance companies, a green economy, and on and on and on, without at the same time recognizing that the conditions that would have made that possible and the assumptions that you would have to have made to make that possible, let us say 20 or 30 years ago, and that assumption was that the dollar had a privileged place in the world, which means you could have both a military empire and presumably a welfare state at home. I think those assumptions have to be thrown to the side. I think what might be driving more of this and the crisis could be the rise of multiple currencies, including the petrol yuan and other currencies, even the euro under certain conditions that challenge the dollar, which then makes the U.S. military empire too expensive to continue. In that kind of circumstance, a real left would have to be in place or arise to explain the conditions that the American working people and poor and middle class face and the path forward.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.